more seats on this side. The topic we have chosen for our consideration today is this an imperfect world? For two Sunday evenings, it's been my very great pleasure to meet with the Pilgrim Fellowship of this church and to discuss with them some of their questions. Not trying to give them neat, complete, authoritative answers, but rather to help them think their way through, which is our congregational way of proceeding. One question they asked was, if God is almighty, why didn't he create a perfect world? I suppose that was a part of their own thinking and echoed a great deal of what they'd heard people say. We thought that a larger audience would like to run that question through their minds. Let's do it this morning. In the first place, might it not be rather presumptuous and short-sighted to conclude offhand that the world is imperfect? You know, that should make us stop and think. You hear it on all sides asserted that it is. If a man went downtown and entered a big printing plant, and without any experience or training in the techniques and procedures of that field, proceeded to tell those who were running that business that they were doing it all wrong, we'd be rather inclined to question that person's balance. And if he also went to a medical clinic and then to different factories and business concerns, each of them requiring years of training to operate, and told them the same thing, they were not doing the thing right, I don't think we'd even hesitate to question that he was entirely off balance. And yet, the sum total of all such human enterprises, with all the time necessary to learn their techniques and procedures, the sum total is infinitesimal compared with the ongoing of this universe. On what grounds do we little human beings dare to say it's not working right? When we say it is imperfect, we assume on our part knowledge that's impossible. We sound rather ridiculous. Then shall we stop questioning and thinking? Not at all. This is what we are told we must do by authoritarian movements. You have not the right or the capacity to ask questions, they say. Believe what you're told on authority. No, rather let us begin to question more effectively and more reasonably. That would lead me to ask this question. There may be other ways to approach this, likely are, but I would proceed by raising this question. Isn't the purpose of a thing a real test of its efficiency or inefficiency, its perfection or its imperfection? If a tool, an instrument, a program, does just what you want it to do, what you made it for, or what you bought it for, isn't that the test? This universe, tested by our interests and our purposes, may seem to be very imperfect. To the indolent man who wants to get by with the least effort and responsibility, this is a very disturbing and disappointing world. It won't leave him alone. To the one who wants the thrills of youth all his life, it's rather disappointing to find maturity and its responsibilities, not to mention its physical lines, creeping up on one. To him, it's a very imperfect world. to the one who wants to do just as he pleases, in spite of the laws and principles of the universe, and then experiences disaster in health and fortune. Why, this is a very imperfect world. And even if we got all our own way, for a time at least, it would still seem inadequate. This last week, some of us heard a play in which a girl was told that if she married a certain man, she would have all the money she could spend. To which she replied, "There isn't that much money." There it is. Even under the best possible circumstance, it was still imperfect. Most, if not all, the tests of the universe we presume to make are in terms of our own little purposes. It is as if a child took hold of some symphonic records, Handel, Beethoven, and others, and presently came back into the house and said to his mother, "Mom, these are not very good. They don't bounce when I throw them. And they bend when I try to build with them. They're not very good records." For him, the records of Handel and Beethoven were dismal failures, tested by his purposes. How often it is that our purposes make this marvelous, mysterious, and wonderful universe seem so imperfect. We don't stop to think that perhaps it wasn't made for our purposes. God's purpose may give an entirely different light on the nature of this universe. It seems reasonable to say that the normal, modest, balanced, adjusted person will naturally presuppose that whoever made this universe likely knows his business and purposes and how to achieve them better than we can tell him. This world, from our point of view, is a world of imperfect people, a world where cruelty and injustice are to be found, sometimes rampant. It's a world where flames burn, and they burn the good as well as the bad. Water drowns, poison kills, storms devastate, and old age and physical decay arrive inevitably. And by the way, accidents are always happening. But whether the presence of these things makes it imperfect, or the absence of them would make it more perfect, depends upon the purpose of the maker. Theoretically, it could still be a perfect world according to the maker's purpose, even if it were completely indifferent to us and our fate. If it's doing what he wants, then from his point of view, it's what he wants. But with very, very good grounds, we've come to believe that we mean something to God. A moral God, a loving God, that he's called us into being for fulfillment and not frustration, that we are born of his spirit, and as his children, we are at the heart of his purpose. If this is so, then his purpose and our welfare according to that purpose must be the test of the perfection or success of this universe. Let's look at it from that point of view. Let's see our question against that background. If God is almighty, why didn't he create a perfect world? In the first place, we should stop, look, and listen, and ask the question, are we not overestimating that word almighty? Remember how in the Garden of Gethsemane Jesus said, "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." But it did not pass. He had to drink it. Evidently, Jesus believed that God's possibilities had limits. Some things are impossible in the very nature of things. Even God cannot make a square circle, unless we're going to make those words mean something quite different from what they usually mean.
some things are impossible to mere might, even to almightiness. Might can compel knees to bow, but it can never make hearts love. Might can fill people with fear, but not with sympathy. Might can compel obedience, but not warm, intelligent cooperation. Only love can do these greater things, and love takes patience and time. The cumulative evidence of the ages, as we survey them from the prehistoric mists down to today, is that the creative purpose is reaching its height in the production of personality. Man as we know him, with all his weaknesses and faults and frailties, is the greatest outcome of the process of the millennia. But God's purpose demands and depends not might, but love. It depends more on love than might. He is primarily interested in producing free thinking, self-governing souls who will love and choose and serve the best, the beautiful and the true. This cannot be compelled by might. To achieve that end, men must be left free to choose and serve the worst, as some do. Or perhaps the more prevalent and therefore the greater tragedy, to serve the second best, which the majority is doing. But why does God allow people to do the cruel and the horrible things that some of them do? Why doesn't he prevent them? This is usually the cry of ignorant desperation. The one saying that doesn't really want God to stop all evil. Only the evil the other fellow's doing. If all evil was stopped, we'd all be stopped dead in our tracks, period. We don't want that. No, to produce the people of his dreams, God had to produce conditions in which we can all make fools of ourselves, which we do, and thereby learn, if possible. But whenever this is discussed, again the cry goes up, but couldn't God create beings who would love and serve only the right, the noble, and the good? To which I answer, without hesitation, yes, he can. And I say so because I see him doing it. I see him in the midst of that work now. He's doing it in the only possible way. Such people are the outcome of the so-called veil of tears, its disciplines and its struggles. This world, with all its tragedies, is the crucible for creating man in the image of God, and there's no shortcut. Only I would not say create or make, but rather that God is loving them into being. They are not the work of his hands so much as the children of his spirit. He is fulfilling his purpose in his own time and his own way. And that is likely the only way. This world, with all its handicaps, all its obstacles, all its hindrances, is the gymnasium of the spirit. It's equipped to do what God wants done. The one thing that justifies the untold ages behind us and makes eternity worthwhile. To create by decree or fiat a being that could do no wrong would be to create a machine. A robot, it could be done. That's all you'd have. A robot. but to create or produce by love a being who will do no wrong is to produce a son of God. Thus, for the divine purpose, this world is a wonderful instrument. If he is seeking to produce spiritual beings to inherit eternity, then this world, with all its obstacles and hurdles and dangers, is a necessary part of the program. The sunshine and storm, beauty and ugliness, the tension between what is and what ought to be, all these and such factors, obnoxious to our petty purposes though they may be, are indispensable to his purpose. All these things rightly handled, and you can mishandle them, and if you do, they're devastating. All these things rightly handled produce spiritual stature and strength and beauty of character and an ever-deepening understanding of the eternal. Accidents may intervene along the way. The perfidy of blind men may disrupt and delay. But, as the Apostle Paul expressed it, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God. His house contains many rooms. We know but one. It's a wonderful room, but not likely the best. And if his purpose is not fulfilled here, it will be in some other room, where the loose ends of life will be caught up and life's unfinished business will be carried out, in a world necessary for our very being and for our growth. We may need to meet tragedy, but there can be no ultimate and final tragedy for those who love God and are committed to his purpose. His world is made to carry out his purpose. Of course, if we want to use the world otherwise, we may. We may want to use it for our own purposes only and find that it never quite fits them. It was not planned for them. We may as well recognize that. We may prefer to sack this world and rob it as we can get our hands into its wealth. We can try to exploit it all for our own ego. We can curse it when we get hurt. We can ignore and defy its laws and its principles. And by our so doing, we may gain some temporary but fading success and ultimate frustration and defeat. But that is our privilege, if we wish. Our terrible, God-given privilege. His love allows it, in the hope that we will choose life in response to his love. Love cannot force the issue. Love can never succeed until it wins response from us. And then we'll know that this wonderful universe is but the vestibule, the antechamber to the still greater dream of our Father.
mention for the benefit of those who are not present that it's our custom in this service to take a few minutes with the young people. Young people, when you speak to God, praying, Our Father, or in your other prayers, I suppose it's inevitable that sometimes you wonder what God is like, and you wonder what he thinks about you, how he sees you. You know, Jesus helped us in both those ways. Somehow Jesus is a reflection or a mirror. When we look at him, we know what God is like. And also, he showed us how God loves and cares for us. Not as a great mass of people, but as individuals. I like to remember a little story which I think helps us understand. Two boys, not very old fellows, were talking one day, and one said, wouldn't you just hate to wear spectacles all the time? The other one listened and seemed hesitant, and he said, well, no, I don't think I would mind. What? Wear spectacles all the time? Well, said the other, I don't think I would mind, not if I had the kind that my grandma wears. The other fellow was puzzled, and he said, well, just what do you mean? Well, he said, she sees how to fix a lot of things. She sees a lot of things to do on a rainy day. She sees when folks are tired or sorry, and she makes them feel better. And she always sees what you meant to do, even if you didn't quite do it. I asked her one day how she could see that way all the time. And she said that was the way she'd learned to look at things and people as she grew older. So it must be her spectacles. No, son, it wasn't her spectacles. It was because she was growing more and more like God. She's beginning to see people as God sees them all the time. And to me, that's a wonderful thought. I want you to take it with you when you leave in a minute or two. He sees how to fix things, too. So there's always something worthwhile to do on sunshiny days as well as rainy days. He sees when we are tired or sorry and what will make us better. And he will make us feel better if we just talk with him. And he always sees what you meant to do, even if you didn't quite make it. You were trying to do your best. And though other people may blame, he sees and smiles and understands. I want you to know that about God. Our Father. May I say, I'd just like to add, thanks, Graham. You helped us to see God and to understand him better. Now will you unite in singing as these young people leave us?